Coronavirus case numbers exploding in El Paso. How the city is trying to treat patients as hospitals reach capacity. Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Just over a week left to Election Day, and it's far from just the presidential race on the ballot. We'll highlight one sheriff's race that's heating up. Plus, transitioning from oil is something even the oil companies are thinking about. We'll learn today why hydrogen might be a clean but not so simple option. And remembering Jerry Jeff Walker, Texas troubadour, cosmic cowboy, and misbehaving musician. Those stories, plus a local debate over masks, a spooky anthology, and more today on the Texas Standard. A high today of 26 in Amarillo, 36 in Midland, and 86 in Corpus Christi. I'm Laura Rice, and it's the Texas Standard for Monday, October 26th. Thanks for joining us. Those all-over-the-place temperatures are probably the reason the TV meteorologist I was watching last night described the forecast as both a disaster and a dumpster fire. This cold front causing some weather whiplash. But hopefully it won't cause you to delay your trip to the polls if you haven't voted yet. We're in the final week of early voting in Texas. And ahead of that, a poll that has some folks all abuzz, showing former Vice President Joe Biden with a slight lead over President Donald Trump here in Texas. The Dallas Morning News University of Texas at Tyler poll puts Biden at 3 points over Trump. The poll was conducted between October 13th and 20th, so before the final presidential debate. Meanwhile, El Paso now in the midst of an explosion of COVID-19 cases. The city is preparing its convention center to care for patients as hospitals reach capacity. Angela Kocherga is news director and a reporter for Public Radio's KTEP in El Paso. She's also a reporter for El Paso Matters. Angela, thanks for your time.
Hi, Laura.
Tell me a little bit more about these rising coronavirus numbers in El Paso, not just new positive cases, but also hospitalizations on the rise.
Yeah, we had a terrible weekend with hospitals reaching capacity, according to the county judge, and really a scramble to try and find extra hospital beds for COVID patients who all last week were being admitted. We had 1 in 3 being admitted, and of course now it's reached that terrible capacity level. So trying to find places and trying to find help. Over the weekend, the governor announced that he'd be sending more resources to El Paso, medical staff, equipment, and helping turn the convention center into a field hospital for up to 100 additional beds. And also the area hospitals mentioned that they would try on a voluntary basis, but would begin to airlift some of the patients that needed intensive care, non-COVID patients originally, to other medical facilities in Texas.
Yeah, that was, I saw reports of that, and I wondered if the convention center was going to mean that airlifting wouldn't still be happening, but it sounds like they're trying everything just to keep the capacity numbers down.
Yeah, they are. They're keeping all their options open. Of course, they want to keep people in El Paso, but you know, it depends on if these terrible numbers come down, and it's a very dire situation.
Now, is the convention center going to be used for COVID patients or for non-COVID patients?
It sounds like it may be COVID patients. They weren't clear about that. And their hope is that they won't need to use it too much. It'll start out with 50 beds and expand up to 100. But again, there's a scramble to find other options and to keep people, you know, in the hospitals. And, you know, hospitals from out of the El Paso area are also providing additional resources as well as the governor, so that they can help local hospitals. The big thing is, you know, we have space, but you need that medical staff. And our staff here is really taxed.
Mm. Do we know what's attributing to this spike in El Paso?
Hard to say, but, you know, like other places, you know, COVID fatigue. We have a lot of young people, you know, football games that started up. I have to tell you, over the weekend, I got a tip about some social gatherings still happening on Saturday. Drove out to this beautiful venue for events on the far edge of El Paso County, and all lit up, and actually, there were two events happening, a quinceañera and a wedding reception. And I approached the manager there and said, what's going on? She said, well, we're allowed to do this. And We do know that the county and the city have offered some waivers on a case-by-case basis, but they said that those waivers would be rescinded as we dealt with this crisis. Clearly, that didn't happen. There were sheriff's deputies on the scene having a heated discussion with the management there, but nothing happened. They left without shutting it down.
So what are the rules right now? I understand city leaders put a curfew in place.
A curfew went into effect last night. The county judge announced it at 5 p.m. and it started at, that night at 10 p.m. So 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Of course, people can still go out for essential work. During the day, everyone is being told stay home unless you have an essential reason to go out. And we heard from the El Paso Health Department director yesterday, Angela Mora. And she again urged people, please don't leave your homes at least for the next 2 weeks.
This is a critical moment we are going through in El Paso, and we call on the members of the community to work with us and cooperate in putting this spread down in the next 14 days by staying home.
So that was El Paso Public Health Director Angela Mora. Do we know the number of hospitalizations in El Paso? Are they meaning a rollback to business reopenings there or not yet?
Well, the numbers climb every day. We're up 300% and new records being set all the time, so it really is concerning. The other issue that both the city and county made clear, the mayor and the county judge, is that voting is an essential reason to leave. They're really concerned. This is the last week of early voting and right. They want people to know they can go to polling places and it's safe. There are safeguards in place.
We've been speaking with Angela Kocherga. She's the news director for KTEP in El Paso. She's also a reporter for El Paso Matters. Angela, thank you again.
Thank you, Laura.
In Tarrant County this election, one of the races on the ballot is for sheriff. Republican Bill Wayburn is running for his second four-year term. A Fort Worth police captain and 20-year veteran of the department, Vance Keyes, is the Democratic challenger. Now, a Texas sheriff's main job is running the county jail. But as Miranda Suarez reports from KERA North Texas, Keyes has also been taking Wayburn to task for a controversial immigration program.
Sitting on a grocery store patio in Fort Worth, Tarrant County Sheriff Challenger Vance Keyes says he's ready to make some changes.
Where do I start? Let me start. Okay, so what do I dislike about the sheriff's department?
One of his main campaign promises is ending the 287G agreement. That program trains deputies to identify undocumented immigrants in the jail and flag them for federal immigration enforcement. It's voluntary, and county commissioners signed off on the agreement in 2017. From June of last year through May of 2020, Tarrant County Sheriff's deputies flagged 307 people. 236 were released to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and of those, 70 got deported. County commissioners renewed the program again this past June, and County Judge Glenn Whitley, a Republican, said the program is worth it if it keeps even one person from being hurt by someone who was released from jail instead of held in custody.
If it was a relative of mine, if it was a friend of mine, then I would look at that and say, I'm glad I did.
But Key says that's just bad law enforcement strategy.
Because if I'm an undocumented person, or if I have a loved one that's an undocumented person, you can say what you want to say. And if I believe that you're going to arrest one of my loved ones or deport one of my loved ones, I'm not going to call law enforcement if I'm a victim or if I'm a witness.
To Keyes, the sheriff's office has no business doing the federal government's job. Only 27 out of the 254 sheriff's offices in Texas participate in 287G. But Wayburn insists the program is helpful.
If we don't use our own discretion in order to hold them fully accountable, then we're sending them back into the neighborhoods. So if we have a responsibility to have safe neighborhoods, then law enforcement should cooperate together.
He put it in even stronger terms during a White House press conference last year, criticizing a federal court ruling that made it harder for the government to detain people it suspects are undocumented.
If we have to turn them loose or they get released, they're coming back to your neighborhood and my neighborhood. These drunks will run over your children and they will run over my children.
Those remarks about releasing immigrants who are repeat offenders drew criticism from Texas Democrats. KERA asked the sheriff's office for the number of people flagged by the 287G program who committed violent crimes. A spokesperson said the office only keeps track of whether an accused crime is a felony or a misdemeanor, not if it's violent or nonviolent. That's a problem for Vance Keyes.
If you tell me you've got this project in a county of 2 million plus people and you snared or you netted 300 people, but then you can't give me numbers on these egregious crimes, I'm going to call baloney.
Wayburn has also been criticized for the state of the Tarrant County Jail. According to the Texas Office of the Attorney General, 10 inmates have died so far this year. That's more than the last 3 years combined. COVID-19 has only been blamed for one of those deaths. Wayburn blames the uptick on his inmates' pre-existing conditions.
I don't think they fall on me to prevent, other than that I provide good, reasonable care and be alert to those things when they happen. And we've done that.
But Wayburn has taken heat for some of what's happened inside the jail. One inmate died by suicide after guards failed to follow the schedule to check on him. The jail lost state certification for 6 days, which means it failed to meet minimum standards. County Commissioner Devin Allen, a Democrat, learned about that in the newspaper. She confronted Wayburn at a meeting in June.
If you quite honestly didn't bother to tell us this, then what else is going on that we perhaps don't know?
Wayburn did tell County Judge Glenn Whitley about the loss of certification, and Whitley said Wayburn followed protocol. To Vance Keyes, though, the sheriff needs to be more open about what goes on inside the jail.
Because I would say, well, Sheriff, yes, you had a bad year. These things happened. They were beyond your control. When there's the lack of transparency and competent accountability, I don't know what's going on.
Wayburn says he's accomplished a lot as sheriff and will continue to help inmates transition back into the community once they leave custody.
I have this philosophy that a large majority of these people that are in jail today will be our neighbors again.
And now it's up to the 1.2 million registered voters in Tarrant County to decide who should wear the sheriff's star for the next 4 years. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
Texas Standard producer Michael Marks is watching the Talk of Texas for us today. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, Laura. At the top of the show, we heard about the serious coronavirus situation in El Paso. On social media, plenty of folks there understandably upset about what's happening in their city. Cynthia from El Paso tweets to her fellow El Pasoans, "Get your stuff, not stuff necessarily, together and wear those masks. It's sad to hear my grandma say she's scared because of people's negligence." Also in El Paso, Judith tweets that, "I'll be that person that'll report any social gathering because I'm tired of COVID." So a really serious situation unfolding there, Laura, but not the only place where cases are on the rise. In Lubbock, 340 new cases reported yesterday. That's the most since the pandemic started.
Wow. Thank you so much, Michael. We'd like to continue to hear from our listeners. You can find us on social media or send us an email, texasstandard@kut.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. The Democratic candidate running for Texas Railroad Commissioner just got a late-game cash infusion from Michael Bloomberg. The Texas Tribune reports the former New York City mayor donated $2.6 million to Krista Castaneda's campaign for a seat on Texas's Oil and Gas Regulatory Commission. Democrat Castaneda is running against Republican Jim Wright. A Democrat hasn't won statewide office in more than 20 years, but Castaneda says her campaign's using the donation to run ads in every major Texas market.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/on the job.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. As COVID-19 spreads in rural communities across Texas, residents are split on the right balance between personal liberty and social responsibility. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh takes us to Kerr County, where a mask mandate is back in place after cases rose.
Temperature scan, nothing's changed from yesterday?
No. Okay. The Peterson Regional Medical Center in Kerrville is big. More than 120 beds and about 1,000 employees.
One in the right or left arm today? Can we do the right arm, please?
Yeah.
Their staff members are all getting vaccinated for the flu.
Stick. Sting. You're finished.
Nothing to it.
Unsurprisingly, hospital workers embrace these basic public health tools.
I like masks. I like hand hygiene. I like social distancing. And I like flu vaccinations.
Pam Burton is the infection preventionist at Peterson Health. She's seen and heard a lot of bad information about COVID-19.
There is a lot of misinformation floating around all over. The internet is a big source of it, as we all know.
But it's not just misinformation. There's also ideology.
People here are entrepreneurial. They're independent. They love their freedom.
Corey Edmondson.
And don't like necessarily to be told what to do.
President and CEO of Peterson Health.
And I respect that, and I'm of the same vein.
Peterson has not been hit hard by COVID-19, even when the summer surge overwhelmed hospitals in other cities.
We even got to the point where we took a few patients from the border communities to treat, to help them out from their surge.
To be sure, cases did rise here over the summer. About a dozen people have died, and hundreds have been infected. Those numbers could be lower with widespread mask use. But on June 29th,
I'll go ahead and start the meeting.
At a Kerr County Commissioners meeting, political ideology and medical misinformation clashed with public health and science.
From my research that I've done and numerous doctors, it's the main problem is glutathione deficiency.
That's an opponent of mask use.
Wait for a vaccine. There's natural remedies that are available.
So at this meeting, there's four county commissioners and the county judge. They sit in a kind of semicircle listening to residents, and only the county judge wears a mask.
Just that wearing masks puts even especially the elderly at risk by not having the proper amount of oxygen.
Masks, as we know, are safe and effective, and there are no proven guaranteed treatments or remedies for COVID. This is the misinformation piece, harmful, bad pseudoscience spread by a handful of residents. But a much larger segment of the community is against a mask mandate for a different reason.
You think back, Kerrville was, and Kerr County and the Hill Country in general, was founded on conservative principles. And that being that a person looked after themselves and their family and their neighbors. And that is encompassing within that, it maybe comes down to just American common sense.
Personal liberty is number one.
We must ensure that we maintain our fundamental right to make these decisions for ourselves with limited government intervention.
So at the end of the meeting, Kerr County Judge Rob Kelly proposed a compromise of sorts.
And that is that I make a motion that we encourage everyone, businesses and individuals, to wear masks in public for themselves and for others if they believe that. And if they don't believe that, they don't. Then, you know, do what you believe. Everybody exercises their own rights.
So what's the motion specific?
For this court to make recommendations to the public to wear masks if you believe that is in your best interest.
I'll second that.
Is there any other discussion? Those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. We work through an issue.
A unanimous decision to keep things exactly the same. We caught up with Commissioner Tom Moser by phone.
Okay, Tom Moser, County Commissioner in Kerr County for Precinct 2.
He moved to the area back in 1994 and really, truly loves Kerr County.
To this day, so now 26 years later, I still think it's the best place in the world to live.
And he knows the community well. He sums up the local thinking on this pandemic and pandemic precautions in a couple sentences.
Every aspect of life has got risk to it unless you just don't do anything. So anytime you are trying to have the freedoms associated with liberty, there's always risk.
But what about ways to moderate the risk? Methods like mask use that allow more of us to do more things with less risk. This is where Moser believes individual choice and personal liberty comes into the mix. He points to the governors of California and New York.
They think they know best what's good for the public. And I don't agree with that at all. And I think that this coronavirus thing is a thing that's enabling people to have more control because that's their philosophy. They want to control. Okay? They want to control.
Well, there are many instances where our personal liberties have been impugned because of greater good.
William Rector is a lifelong resident of Kerrville, and he practiced medicine here for about 3 decades.
Wearing a seatbelt is one. Driving the speed limit is one. Placing a child in a child carrier in a vehicle. Those are all things that are against our personal liberties, but we do them because we realize that they save lives.
Dr. Bill Rector.
Honorable Commissioners, Honorable Judge Kelly.
He spoke at that Kerr County Commissioners meeting back in late June.
And that wearing masks will do is to restore our economy.
The meeting where the Commissioners Court voted to keep things the same, no mask mandate.
So it was disappointing. But I think that looking in retrospect, it was not the decision that we needed for this community, because after that meeting, the number of cases of COVID in Kerrville began to rise, and rise rather rapidly.
Cases were rising exponentially across Texas. And then on Thursday, July 2nd, just a few days after the Kerr County Commissioners meeting,
Texans are resilient.
Governor Greg Abbott puts out a YouTube video. A mask with a Texan flag rests on his desk. He presents graphs with alarming trend lines. COVID is surging in Texas.
COVID-19 is not going away. In fact, it's getting worse.
He implements a statewide mask order.
Our numbers begin to drop down significantly.
It took a while. The trend line didn't really flatten out until August. And then
our county judge decided that, hey, things are so cool, we can take away the masks. And when that happened, our numbers started going back up again.
Kerr County Judge Rob Kelly did not respond to TPR's interview request. Earlier this month, he took a closer look at the data and backpedaled on the mask issue, requesting the state put the county back on the mask mandate list. So masks are required again, but local law enforcement is not enforcing the mandate because of the way it's written and, in the sheriff's office, because they believe it is unconstitutional. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in the Texas Hill Country.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Lubbock area will have to tighten pandemic restrictions due to high levels of COVID-19 hospitalizations. Sunday marked the 7th day in a row coronavirus patients exceeded 15% of all hospitalizations. Lubbock's Mayor Dan Pope says businesses operating at 75% capacity will now have to reduce to 50%. Area hospitals must also restrict elective medical procedures under the governor's reopening guidelines.
The biggest impact, I think, will be on our hospitals with the elective surgeries, and that impacts not only the hospitals, but the people who work at the hospitals.
Pope was speaking to KAMC-TV on Friday before the area surpassed the state's threshold for COVID-19 hospitalizations. Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris visits Texas on Friday. As TPR's Paul Flav reports, the U.S. Senator from California previously canceled a trip to the state after a staff member tested positive for COVID-19.
Harris is the highest-profile Democrat to visit from the campaign this season. The announcement Sunday follows two prominent October polls showing President Donald Trump trailing Vice President Joe Biden. The state has not voted for a Democrat since 1976. Texans have shattered early voting records this season with now more than 7 million votes cast. That includes many more first-time voters. Harris will be visiting the state on the final day of early voting. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
And more than 7.3 million Texans have already voted early. The family of a black man who died last year in the custody of Williamson County Sheriff's deputies is suing the Central Texas County. Officers used tasers on Javier Ambler II 4 times in March of 2019 after chasing his car for failing to dim his headlights. A crew from the reality TV show Live PD was filming at the time. The Austin American-Statesman reports the federal lawsuit was filed Sunday. Among the allegations is that the Williamson County Sheriff's Office promoted a culture of violence for Live PD, which was canceled in June. And the Texas Panhandle and South Plains are in for another round of freezing rain, sleet, and snow early this week. A wintry mix overnight and this morning has left icy roads and dangerous driving conditions in the region. National Weather Service meteorologist Ed Andrade in Amarillo says temperatures will remain below freezing through midweek.
The main storm system will be moving towards us and across us Tuesday night and Wednesday, and that's when we expect the much heavier precipitation amounts and the heavier snow totals and the heavier icing totals during Tuesday night into Wednesday evening.
Freezing weather is forecast to extend farther south into West Texas. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. One of the hot clips from last week's debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden was Biden's commitment to transitioning away from oil. But it should come as no surprise to regular Texas Standard listeners, because we've talked before about how some major oil companies themselves are shifting their focus to greener energy. It's especially happening with European oil companies, including BP and Royal Dutch Shell. Now, when we talk about green energy, we typically think of renewables, such as solar and wind, two industries where Texas is emerging as a power player. But as interest grows in reducing fossil fuel emissions, another fuel source is attracting interest and investments from oil companies: hydrogen. Here to tell us more is Energy Insider Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, Laura.
So how can hydrogen be used, and how realistic are its prospects?
Well, Laura, hydrogen can be used to generate electricity or power and heat. It's currently most commonly used at the moment in petroleum refining and fertilizer production, but it's looking to be developed to be used by utilities and in transportation, because for the reasons that you mentioned, it burns far more cleanly than fossil fuels. It currently accounts for a very small piece of the pie in terms of the world's energy supply, sort of under 5%. But some of the more optimistic estimates peg it at meeting nearly a quarter of consumption by 2050. That's a very lofty expectation, but still one that is pretty impressive, really. But for that to happen, it's going to take government policies to essentially promote it, because it's higher cost than, say, natural gas. And it's likely going to be for a couple of decades. So it needs subsidies and tax credits to make it more cost competitive versus those fossil fuels.
But some oil companies are sort of already doing this on their own, or are these European companies getting some nudges to do that?
Both, actually, yeah. So as big oil tries to pivot away from fossil fuels, hydrogen is emerging as the next big bet. So oil and gas majors such as Shell, Equinor and BP, they've spent tens of millions of dollars on pilot projects. And then you've got other companies in Europe such as Repsol, who's pledging to spend a quarter of its CapEx, its capital expenditures, on low carbon projects through 2025, so focusing on renewables and hydrogen. But at the same time as well, particularly in Europe there, you've got the support on a government level. So a country such as Germany has thrown $10 billion to this industry. So there is very much a push. But as you mentioned, like particularly with, say, Texas, with solar and wind, they are kind of that go-to source in terms of the fight against climate change. Hydrogen burns extremely hot, whereas renewables such as wind and solar can't deliver quite that level of heat. So some industries such as making steel or cement or chemicals, they need those extreme temperatures. And that's really where hydrogen has the advantage.
Now, this, I feel like, is a stupid question, but, growing up with chemistry classes, I'm thinking H2O, that's just water. And this is hydrogen and oxygen, but obviously this is some kind of different mixture. And it can be used to power everything, or at least eventually that's the goal?
Yeah, that's it. And so you get it via a couple of different methods. So one is essentially steam methane reforming, where you're getting natural gas to react with steam to produce hydrogen. And then you have partial oxidization, which is where you essentially combust that natural gas and you create the hydrogen with carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide.
Interesting. So what does the future of hydrogen look like? Is this just a trendy investment as energy companies are trying to look more, you know, quote, green? Or is there real opportunity here?
There seems like there is real opportunity. There is just that kind of cost prohibitive element to it. There's a number of different stipulations, actually. They're broken out by color, essentially. So there's four different ones and really three different buckets. You have green hydrogen, which is made from renewable resources, and it's the most cleanest. And then in the second bucket, you've got blue hydrogen, which is when you're using natural gas or coal to produce that hydrogen. Then you're capturing the carbon dioxide, because that's the issue, is that creation of the carbon dioxide. So if you can capture and store that, that's good for the environment. The final bucket is gray and brown hydrogen. The gray is natural gas used to produce hydrogen, and brown is with coal. But that resulting CO2 is pushed down into the air. And like with everything, really, the cleanest version of this, the green hydrogen, that's the most expensive one, while the least environmentally friendly one, the gray brown hydrogen with the coal and blue, is the cheapest. And so it all comes back to economics.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thank you for explaining all this.
Thank you so much, Nora.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
Hi, my name is Incher Yeo, and I am co-publisher of Castle Bridge Media.
Hi, my name is Jason Henderson. I'm a co-publisher of Castle Bridge Media.
There's always been kind of a fascination with horror between us. We both grew up in Killeen, Texas, and we used to have sleepovers and do all sorts of hikes in the woods together. And I would start a story that I thought, there's no way you can turn this into a horror story or have a bad or scary ending. Like, okay, I'm a runner in a race. I see the finish line, it's right in front of me, and I'm gonna win this race. And Jason would say something like, oh, well, the tape that goes across the finish line is too high, and the runner, you know, cuts his head off as he crosses the finish line.
For several years, we've been doing a podcast called The Castle of Horror, where we focus on classic movies. And so we founded Castle Bridge Media to start publishing anthology books, patterned after those old horror short story anthologies that we used to get, you know, in used bookstores.
For Volume 3, which is our last summer anthology, it was Scary Summer Stories. And the story I wrote for that book was called The Rising. Quite a few years ago, I had a friend who was getting married, and we rented a house for him to have kind of like a bachelor party. And we went out into the middle of the Texas Hill Country. And so that kind of inspired my story. Well, actually, the character's alone. He goes before everyone else, and he's alone. And there's a massive flood that happens. The river rises, and things start floating in the river that aren't supposed to be there. And it's open kind of a portal into something mysterious.
My name is Drew Wally. I live in Dripping Springs, Texas, and the title of my story is At Last Count. It is based at a fictional Central Texas summer camp, but it is inspired by a real camp that I worked at back in the mid-90s as a camp counselor. And, you know, like many summer camps, it had its resident story about the bad guy that was there or something that was out in the woods that was going to get you. So that was sort of the inspiration for it.
Castle of Horror Anthology 4 is called Women Running from Houses.
It's kind of a meme now. The old Victorian Gothic horror novels, like in the 70s and the 80s, always featured a woman on the cover running from a house. And so we kind of are taking that idea and asking writers to submit their own.
We've got funny ones, we've got classic gothic stories, we've got gender bent, we've got all sorts of wonderful variations on women running from houses. I'm Jason Henderson. I'm a co-publisher at Castle Bridge Media.
This is Drew Wally. I'm a writer in Dripping Springs, Texas.
My name is Inchur Yeo. I am co-publisher of Castle Bridge Media, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. He was born Ronald Clyde Crosby in the Appalachian region of New York. He then had stints in Greenwich Village, the Florida Keys, and New Orleans. But it wasn't until Jerry Jeff Walker landed in Austin that he felt truly at home. He told Rolling Stone magazine in 1974, "Texas was the only place where they didn't look at me like I was crazy." The famed singer-songwriter passed away in Austin on Friday after a battle with cancer. He was 78. Here to talk about his life and his contributions to the Texas music scene is John T. Davis, a Texas-based journalist, author, and former publicist for Jerry Jeff Walker. John, thanks for joining us, and I'm so sorry about your friend.
Well, I am sorry, too. It was not totally unexpected, but you never want to see that day arrive.
Absolutely. Now, Jerry Jeff was probably best known for his song, Mr. Bojangles. Can you tell us a little bit about the story behind that song?
Well, he was a street performer in New Orleans back in the 60s, and he liked to get on the outside of some wine sometimes, and by hook and by crook, he wound up in the drunk tank down in the French Quarter. And his old partner, David Bromberg, said Jerry Jeff was not there on a research project. And he wound up sharing a cell in this drunk tank with another street performer who called himself Bojangles.
Met him in a cell in New Orleans, I was down and out. He looked to me to be the eyes of age. Spoke right out.
Jerry at the time was experimenting with internal rhyme. He'd been reading a lot of Dylan Thomas. So he sort of constructed this sort of 6-8 time waltz with the verse and chorus to sort of turn back around on each other. And it just became an irresistible story. The resonance, the real life resonance of it, really struck everybody that heard it.
Now, you mentioned Jerry Jeff was a street performer himself, singing for cash on street corners. Was there any part of that that impacted his, you know, later, more mainstream career?
Well, I think it gave him the storyteller's gift. I think he drew a lot of his music from life and a sort of an everyman approach. I think his songs are so relatable. Because they sort of touch on people's everyday experiences.
What first brought him to Texas? And I guess more importantly, why did he stay?
As I recall, he was traveling through and just saw a music scene that embraced him and that he could relate to. It was at the time when the fusion of country and rock and folk and blues was just beginning to occur here in Austin. He found it a real creative, fermented kind of scene that he could ingratiate himself into and become a part of. And I think the physical beauty of the city appealed to him as well.
Yeah, and every day I'm bound to walk a strange new road. By myself, live it right or wrong. Yeah.
Do you think his particular brand was a little harder to pin down than others who reached to this superstardom level?
Well, Jerry started out as a folk singer, but when he got this wonderfully eclectic, talented group of musicians who came to be known as the Los Gonzo Band, they could play anything. They gave Jerry a lot of elbow room in terms of what he could do musically. Jerry Jeff could go across the musical spectrum, and because he had this wonderful group of musicians backing him up.
If you had to encompass him in a sentence or two, how would you want folks to remember him?
He always prided himself on being a musician first and foremost. No matter how late the party went the night before, there was never a day that I can recall that he didn't spend at least part of the day working on a song or a lyric or a melody or something. He had that working man's ethic that marks a true musician, and I think that's how he would want to be remembered.
John T. Davis is a Texas-based journalist, author, and former publicist for Jerry Jeff Walker's Tried and True music label. John, thank you again.
It's all my pleasure.
I like the feeling I get lost in a song.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Many U.S. asylum seekers are stuck in Ciudad Juarez, across the border from El Paso, because of the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. That program, formerly called the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, forces those seeking asylum to wait in Mexico until their U.S. hearing. But the COVID-19 pandemic has put those hearings on hold. In the final part of the Asylum Trap series, KERA's Mallory Falk looks at what the election could mean for thousands of people stuck on the border, including one couple with an unexpected love story.
Democratic nominee Joe Biden has pledged to end MPP during his first 100 days in office. But what would that actually look like?
Yeah, so that's kind of the $64,000 question.
Nico Palazzo is an attorney with Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center and represents clients in MPP. He says a new administration could stop placing people in the program. But what about everyone who's already in MPP, waiting in Mexico?
I don't expect, you know, the last week of January for the gates to be open and people just allowed to shuffle in. We're talking thousands of people.
Those people, they came to the U.S. seeking asylum. Immigration officials gave them a court date, then sent them across the border to wait in Mexico. During that wait, two of them fell in love.
Nosotros venimos acá sin ningún pensamiento de que me voy a casar.
Jose is a nurse who fled political persecution in Nicaragua. We're not using his full name since his asylum case is still under review. After he was put in MPP, he found his way to a migrant shelter. He noticed a woman there and struck up a conversation. He learned she was from Guatemala, also here seeking asylum. At first, Jose got her number, but not her name.
I just put Guate in the phone. I never thought I'd meet someone who I just connected with like that. People say, oh, that's just a passing thing. But it's not. When you find the ideal person, someone who gives you the support you were lacking, the embrace you didn't have.
They moved in together, sharing a room at the shelter. Their asylum cases are in different stages, and their future together is uncertain. Still, he asked her to marry him. She said yes. They're expecting a baby next month. Attorney Nico Palazzo says asylum seekers in MPP, like Jose and his fiancé, should be paroled into the U.S. to wait out their legal proceedings.
Can you imagine living in Mexico, not knowing anyone, having very little resources, and being able to effectively prepare and do all of the hard work that is involved in defending yourself in immigration proceedings and requesting asylum?
Plus, it can be dangerous. Palazzo says in the U.S., it's also easier to get a lawyer. Just 7% of asylum seekers in MPP have had legal representation, according to an analysis from the Track Immigration Project at Syracuse University. And they'd make their cases in courtrooms where they'd likely face better odds.
Their court case is going to be changing venue, so it's going to go to another jurisdiction like New York City or San Francisco, where, quite frankly, the courts tend to have significantly lower denial rates of asylum.
Sí, aquí está mi carnet de estudiante de la Universidad de Enfermería.
That would help Jose, who thinks he has a legitimate asylum claim, since he says he was targeted by the government in Nicaragua. getting out of MPP and into the U.S. would be just the beginning. The Trump administration has taken more than 400 executive actions on immigration.
The Trump administration's approach is assuming that no one is a legitimate asylum seeker.
Sarah Pierce is with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. She says with a new administration,
it's difficult to say how they would align the many interlocking policies that are at the southern border.
But she says because MPP was essentially just handed down as a memo, it could be easier to unwind than some other policies. And even if Trump is reelected, MPP is also being challenged in court. For now, Jose and his fiancée turn to each other for strength.
She's given me a lot of emotional support, and I've tried to support her, saying, don't get down, you know, come on, let's go out, get some taquitos in the plaza to cheer up. We just give each other understanding, affection.
One way or another, they and thousands like them are hoping MPP comes to an end, so they can start rebuilding their lives. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And that sound means it's time again to check in with producer Michael Marks, who's watching what Texans are talking about today. What are you seeing out there, Michael?
Earlier in the show, Laura, we heard from John C. Davis about his friend, Jerry Jeff Walker, died in Austin on Friday at 78 from throat cancer. Walker, of course, an auteur of that cosmic cowboy sound, so essential to Texas music. Sure, folks, lifted a little sangria from Terlingua to Luckenbach this weekend. Wanted to share just a few of these remembrances I saw on social media. This one comes to us from Nicole LeBlanc on the Texas Standard Facebook page, particularly apt for this moment in time. Nicole writes, I was one of thousands of DFW area Democrats who gathered at Alliance Airport very late the night of November 2nd, 1992. It was Bill and Hillary Clinton's last stop and last rally before flying home to Arkansas. The atmosphere was electric, with Ann Richards whipping up the crowd as we waited into the wee hours of Election Day for their plane to land. Musical entertainment was provided by Jerry Jeff Walker. And President Clinton himself sharing that memory on Twitter yesterday. He tweeted, I was saddened to hear about the passing of Jerry Jeff Walker. I'll never forget seeing him at the Armadillo Music Hall, he says, in Austin in 1972, or his performance for my 1992 campaign the night before Election Day. A true original, his music will still live on. Twitter user Garrett concurs with that last bit. He writes, I'd say, may Jerry Jeff's legacy live on, but that implies an uncertainty that it absolutely 100% will, so that won't be necessary. Corsicana, Linda Sloan tweets, rest in peace, Jerry Jeff Walker. Your music shaped who I am, and my children carry on your message. And yes, it does make me want to dance. And in Austin, the Invisible Woman tweets, back in the late 90s, I worked at a travel agency in a bookshop. Jerry Jeff Walker came in frequently, one of the nicest human beings ever. I would never recognize him until he spoke. Even his speaking voice was undeniable. So a lot of folks in this part of the world sharing what Jerry Jeff Walker meant to them now that we are in a world without him, if not his music anyway.
Well, and a shout out to our producer, Leah Scarpelli, who made my interview with his friend so beautiful, adding his music. So, because you know, we can't talk about him without also hearing the music that he shared with all of us.
No doubt. Well, that's what Leah Scarpelli does. She makes things sound wonderful.
Absolutely. So thank you to Leah, our director. Thank you to Casey Cheek, our technical director, back in the KUT studios, manning the booth and making sure all the buttons are pushed and we get on the air. Important stuff. Thank you to all of our staff, and thank you so much for listening. You can always find us online, texasstandard.org. We're also in podcast form, so if you miss the show, hey, find us there. Thanks so much.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.